Hey, 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 you're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 at WJCT. All right, so today we have a conversation about labor and why workers are striking all over the country and how government shutdowns could impact the First Coast. Then Create Jax shares this week's most anticipated local events. And All Beaches Experimental Theater is here to discuss the launch of their historical yet timely new production. But first, in the last year, frustrated workers across the U.S. have staged walkouts and gone on strike at significantly higher rates than in previous years. Florida is a right-to-work state, but it is not without unionized workers. So we're going to take a look at how the major shutdowns coupled with the impending government shutdown can impact residents here and our local economy. Joining me today are Russell Harper, president of the North Florida Central Labor Council. Russell, how are you doing this morning?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being here. And Dr. Robert Amberg, assistant
Omberg.
Yes. Yeah. Dr. Robert Amberg, assistant professor of economics at Jacksonville University. And Dr. Amberg, you told me to call you Tucker, yeah. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So Tucker, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
All right. And you can join the conversation from home. Call us at 549-2937. You can tweet at FCC on air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all the channels. You know where to find us. Before we dive in, I need to disclose that I am an active member of the WGA. I was on strike for 5 months. So when we talk about these labor issues, I'm not just a journalist. I am an active participant. So I just want everybody to know exactly where I'm coming from. And, you know, we won the strike, so it's a great thing. When we talk about labor unions, Russell, this country has a long history of them. It feels like in the last, I don't know, and this is not a scientific, like I don't have the numbers to back this up, but it just feels like in the last 10 to 20 years that the idea of labor, I don't know, just kind of took a hit. Like it wasn't as important, at least in our conversations in the country, as it has been like in this last year. It feels like it really like spiked in this last year.
Well, I think part of that is the generations of how they were raised and how they feel about unions and being represented. But also a lot more workers are getting fed up with their work condition, their wages, you know, have not having a safe workplace. It's not all about the money. It's also about dignity in your workplace and being treated fair and coming home safely. But it seems that more and more people are getting involved because they realize that if they don't have a union, they're begging for whatever they get. Mm-hmm. Part of the saying we used to say is individually we beg, collectively bargain. So you can get all the things mentioned before. But it does seem that some more and more people are feeling that unions are important. They need them.
Yeah.
There was a time when there was a decline. But it seems to be turning around because, like I say, the workforce is getting, or the employers are getting harder and harder and greedier, so the workers feel like they need to do something to protect themselves.
Yeah, and I would say that we've seen a real shift in our economy and in the exactly what America makes and how it's created and what our economy looks like. And so, you know, Tucker, in the last 20 years, we've seen like the rise of Amazon and online retailers, so forth. And that creates a whole new workforce. I was driving down, I was on the west side, and I was driving past the old, it used to be a Kmart, and now it's a distribution area for Amazon. And there's a lot of people that go in there and are working. It's factory settings.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there's been a large transition in our economy. And I think your sentiment that there seems to be a rise in interest in unions is backed up in the data. Public opinion on unions has recently reached an all-time high. Americans have a very favorable view of unions. And in 2023, there were a lot more workers on strike than in previous years, about 300,000 workers. We're on strike. But I think if we take a more historical perspective and we compare union activity today to the heyday of unions in between the 1950s and the 1970s. I said that in 2023, about 300,000 workers have gone on strike, which sounds like a lot. But during the heyday of unions, we were seeing up to 4 million workers going on strike every year. And during that same period, about 35% of American workers were in a union. It recently reached an all-time low of about 10%. So while there has been this increased interest in unions, I would say that as a whole, unions as a force in the economy are still much, much less influential than they have been in the past.
Would you say that unions have been a factor in helping create the middle class in America?
So there's a lot of debate as to exactly what extent unions play in improving the welfare of workers as a whole. So we know we can be very confident that unions are good for their members. Across a lot of research, if you compare union and non-union workers, even those with identical experience and education, union workers tend to make 10 to 20% more. The question of whether or not they've helped the middle class as a whole is a little bit more ambiguous. So you can even, from a bird's eye view, just compare countries like the United States and Switzerland, where unionization rates are very low, you know, between 10 and 15%, to countries like Denmark or Sweden or Norway, where unionization rates can be as high as 60 or 70%. And there doesn't seem to be a big difference in average wages between those countries. The U.S. and Switzerland, Belgium, other countries with fairly low unionization rates tend to have similar median incomes to countries with really high unionization rates.
Just want to like nudge at the numbers on that right there, right? So like when we're talking about places like Switzerland and other places that you say have equal, those countries actually like have a safety net that the United States does not have, correct?
Yeah, so that's an issue, and this might come up when we talk about right to work later, is that it can be hard to pinpoint the effect of one thing when you're making comparisons across countries or across states.
Sure.
So it's hard to know, okay, is this because of unions? Is this because of some other policy that the government's instituting?
And Russell, how long have you been a member of a union?
Since 1975.
Wow, that's a long time. That's almost as long as I've been alive.
Hey, you're going to be the old guy one day, though.
Well, knock on wood, let's hope so. Why did you join a union way back when?
Well, I was kind of led to it by my father because he was a non-union electrician for many, many years and tried hard to get in a union. And it was hard in those days to get in a union back then. But I saw what he did working non-union. I worked with him on weekends because his boss was too cheap to hire anybody else. And so I saw the difference early on. So there was no doubt that I would be in the union when I became an electrician.
Yeah. And so what does it mean to be in a union in Florida, which is a right-to-work state?
You mean right to work for less?
You said it.
We don't actually. They don't correctly interpret a lot of that. I don't believe. But the right to work, you already have the right to join a union or not join a union. You didn't need to put it in there. But we've had it. We were one of the first two states to have it since 1942 or 1943. It makes it more difficult. You have more rules and regulations to follow. You can't obligate somebody to join a union. And I know they're fighting that throughout the country, but basically it's just a way to hold the workers down.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps them from joining a union, or it keeps the unions from getting their money. The state of Florida has gone after unions with the, you can't deduct your union dues anymore. And they're just attacking the unions. So, besides being a right-to-work state, they're making another attack. But there are various laws and things you do different if it's a right-to-work state versus not a right-to-work state.
Sure. So in the I've been a part of two unions in my life. First, when I was a flight attendant, I was a part of the union for flight attendants. I can't remember the union. And as a writer for television, I've been a part of the WGA, I think, for 5 years now. With both of those, you just really don't have a choice. I always wanted to be a part of the unions. It wasn't an issue for me because I felt like the protections that they offered, made it worth it to give my dues to it. but you didn't have a choice. Like with being a flight attendant, like they automatically took your union dues out of your paycheck. With the WGA, they do not take dues out of your paycheck, but you have to report what you made, and then they send you a bill, and you pay it out that way. But it's kind of non-negotiable. And so you're saying in Florida, workers have the right to say, I don't want to be a part of the union, and they don't have to get that deducted from their check.
That is correct. There are some rare exceptions to that. But yeah, any work job in Florida, you decide. Now each union, like you're talking about the different ways they do their dues, all the unions have different ways of doing it. But you cannot be forced to join a union in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm. So I think I've said that I've been a part of two unions. And so this is a little bit of a hard question for a union man, because it's a question that like I've been thinking through in my head for years now. So when I was a flight attendant, I had a coworker who had an alcohol problem. And there were two of us on these planes. We were flying, back then they were the prop planes. They were called ATR-72s. And so on an ATR-72, you just have two flight attendants. And we would get up early in the morning. And because that flight attendant had a drinking problem, she would drink all night. And she'd come to the plane, and she wasn't sober. She would sleep in the baggage handler on the first couple flights, and I'd work them by myself. And then when she was feeling better, she would work. And basically she didn't want me to work because she felt bad. She was just trying to make up for it. Anyway, she ended up getting let go, and then they brought her back. The union fought to get her job back, and she was still doing the same thing. And ultimately she ended up, after like being let go like three different times, she ended up coming back. To me, like the issue that I had was that she was a real safety risk, but the union still fought for her to keep her job. And so it's like, I don't know. I've been struggling with that for years. Like you want to like show solidarity within the union, and everybody should be protected. But when somebody's not doing the job, the union still feels like it has to protect that person, right?
Well, that actually ends up into a liability or responsibility. You're taking that worker's dues, so you have to try to represent them. But it's not all about representing. I mean, they should have maybe had an employee assistance program and got her some help, medical or whatever type help. But you have to represent your workers, but you also have to look at it. And there is a line where, I mean, if the person's not working, this is Russell Harper speaking, but I think there's a point where you draw the line and say, I can't represent you anymore. You're causing your own problems.
Yeah.
But like I say, an employee assistance program would be a great help to somebody like that.
Yeah. It's the nature of it, of a union in itself, that in order for the union to be strong, it has to represent everybody. But at the same time, maybe some of those people, they have issues that in some ways can hurt the union.
Well, part of it actually is a legal issue, because that individual could go to the Department of Labor and file a failure to represent. Now, it may or may not win, but you have to be careful looking at all the angles, because you do have to represent the workers if you take their money, but also you have to look at the actual, all the parameters of what's going on.
Sure. So the strikes that we're facing right now in the auto industry, that feels unprecedented to me. Like I've never seen a union take on three major car companies at the same time. It feels feels incredibly bold and maybe smart. I turn to you, Tucker. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I can't speak particularly to the exact factors of what's going on in the auto industry. But what I can say is that, like I was saying earlier, while it might seem like union activity is reaching all-time highs, the reality is that unions are a much weaker force than they have been, especially in previous decades. So even looking at the length of United Auto Workers strikes, There were much larger strikes in previous decades.
Sure, but it does feel the fact that they're taking on all three at the same time feels extremely bold.
To me, it's just a strategic move. I personally think it was a pretty smart move. Take on all three of them at once instead of dealing with them one at a time. And they all have the same threat of a strike at the exact same time. So it kind of shuts down the country's production and all the parts, the vehicles. So to me, it was a smart strategic move to go after all three at once.
Sure. So we've got a comment from Facebook. This is John. He says, it feels like we're back in the 70s. Wasn't the strike from the auto sector and the restaurant wages and more strikes the same inflation spiral we're in now? Can you comment on the difference today versus the 70s? So I guess he's trying to think about like the crazy inflation that was going on in the 70s with the strikes.
I think that unions and unions are not the primary driver of inflation. That has to do mostly with what the Federal Reserve is doing, in addition to broader macroeconomic stuff. So in the 1970s, you had the formation of OPEC and a huge spike in oil prices lead to inflation. And the inflation we're seeing now probably doesn't have anything to do with unions. It has more to do with our government's policy during the pandemic and the amount of spending that they did, in addition to supply chain bottlenecks and that kind of stuff. So I wouldn't think that there's much connection between union activity and inflation.
Yeah. Listen, listeners at home, you can join the conversation. Call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, all the places. Please, we want to hear from you. Reach out. So, Russell, what do you think the future of labor is in the United States? Do you think that unions are going to grow given this flex of power that they've done? I mean, the WGA's win over, and I think it's fair to call it a win over the AMPTP. I always have to think about that, those initials. Their win over the AMPTP, it feels like it was a bit of a sea change possibly in the way that people could look at unions. Because when you look at the numbers, majority of the American public were with the writers on this, no matter what the AMPTP tried to say about writers, and no matter what they say about actors, on a whole, like the numbers that we have say that the American public supports it. So do you think that that could lead to seeing more more places being unionized? Like, I'm thinking specifically about like Amazon, which has traditionally fought against unions, and I believe there's one Amazon distribution center.
Yes, there was one Amazon distribution center that voted to unionize.
But the rest of them so far have not.
No.
Russell, what do you think?
Well, I think the more people get tired of being shafted in the workplace and abused and unsafe conditions, I think there's going to be more of an incline of people wanting to join the unions, more trying to organize like Amazon, Starbucks went through it. You know, the Starbucks here in town shut their doors after they unionized, a terrible thing to do. You couldn't do that in a non-right-to-work state.
Yeah. So let's go to the phones. We've got Dave in Nassau County. Dave, how are you this morning?
I'm well, thanks, Dave. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I just wanted to mention that in response to a previous listener's issue regarding the 70s and inflation, no one is talking about the fact that the largest driver of inflation today is corporate greed. Corporations are making record profits. They're not sharing them with their workers. Instead, they are spending them on buybacks of stock or in dividends for their stockholders or massive compensation for their executive staff. So the very premise that wages are a major factor in inflation is just a patent lie. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Hey, Dave, thanks for calling a lot. Tucker, what do you think about that?
Yes, we've certainly heard a lot about this greedflation narrative, that what happened during the pandemic was that corporations were able to somehow collude with each other to raise prices. I tend to be a bit more skeptical of that narrative. I think that because we see falling prices in a lot of industries, you can look at what happened with eggs last year. We saw a massive increase in the price of eggs. In January, eggs went up to, I think, twice what they were, and then a couple weeks later they went back down. A greed story doesn't really explain that very well. Either the companies got very, very greedy and then all of a sudden decided to become generous. A better explanation is just supply and demand. There was a bird flu that killed a lot of the chickens. And so I think the inflation that we're seeing now is primarily not due to corporate greed. Again, it has to do with one, monetary and fiscal policy, a lot more demand coming from consumers, which raises prices. And then also some things on the supply side, pandemic-related supply chain bottlenecks. He was right that corporate profits are up, but the main reason why that seems to be happening is not because they're greedy, but because the prices of final goods, the things that consumers are buying, tend to rise faster with inflation than the price of inputs, the things, the costs that producers are incurring. So that's leading to the profits, not any increased greed.
Just to maybe follow the line from what Dave is saying, the numbers, though, tell us that CEO pay has skyrocketed, while the pay from every day from the workers have basically been stagnant. Is that correct?
It's actually a little bit more complicated than that. So it's true that if you look at the median wage of non-supervisory employees between 1970 and now and adjust it for inflation, it tends to be pretty flat. But that might not be telling the full story, because workers don't just receive wages, they also receive benefits. So when we include the fact that workers are being paid benefits, we see a much larger increase in compensation between the 1970s and now. A lot of this reflects the fact that health insurance premiums have gotten a lot more expensive. And so employers are spending a much larger fraction of compensation on healthcare.
I hear that, but like that doesn't help me when I'm going to the store and like my wages are let me just make sure that I'm getting the argument right. So what you're saying is that the actual wage has kind of stayed flat, but because we have benefits and because the amount that it costs for healthcare has gone up, when you look at it, it looks like overall pay has gone up. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah. So the measure you'd want to look at isn't wages; it's total compensation.
It's total compensation.
And so total compensation has kept a much closer track with productivity than just wages has.
Right, but that doesn't change what's in my pocket.
That's absolutely true. It can be the fact that health insurance premiums are getting a lot more expensive is obviously a burden to workers.
Sure.
But it reflects more this problem of higher healthcare costs than it does employers underpaying their workers.
But you hit the nail on the head just a second ago. You said profit has gone up for these corporations. They're not sharing that with the workers. And that's what yes, healthcare costs go up. Loaf of bread goes up. Gas went up. The vehicles, they're charging a ridiculous amount for them. But the workers not getting a fair share of it. That's where we need the unions.
Real wages actually have been increasing since the end of the pandemic. There was a big spike in real wages during the pandemic and then immediately after they fell. But they have been increasing since.
And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Kimberly on the west side. Kimberly, how are you this morning?
Hey, I'm well, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'm wondering if your roundtable can discuss, you spoke about the right to work laws in the state of Florida. Can you please touch on the exemptions that were carved out in those laws for firefighters and for law enforcement and unions? And the political implications for those exemptions?
Sure. Russell, can you take that?
Well, there are different types of unions, and the right to work in the Florida Constitution doesn't break out the firefighters and the police. In the same paragraph in the Constitution is where the public workers have the right to collectively bargain. We have a situation at the Navy bases where they do actually have to pay a representation fee because they're a federal enclave established before 1942 or 43 when right to work went into place. But absolutely there's political implications in Tallahassee of who gets carved out of everything that hurts the unions and the workers.
Let's go to the phones again. We've got John. John, how are you this morning?
Hey, doing not too bad. How are you guys doing?
Good. What you got for us?
Yeah, so my question is,
about the supply and demand when it comes to pricing everything and not factoring in the amount of money that was printed when it comes to calculating that supply and demand, because money is how we signal to each other across the world, like what is valuable, what is worth something, you know. And then when you take that signal and you alter it by printing a bunch of money, then everybody has to recalculate. So I was just wondering if anybody's thought of that. I'll just take my answer off the line.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
No, you're absolutely right that one of the major drivers of this most recent episode inflation was monetary policy. It was the Federal Reserve had to print a lot of money to help with pandemic aid. And maybe it was worth it, but that does have the side effect of raising demand. If all consumers have more money in their pockets from the Federal Reserve, then think about an auction where everyone suddenly has more money, prices get bid up. And so that is, you're absolutely right, a primary driver of the most recent episode of inflation. And it's why the Federal Reserve has had to take these aggressive measures in increasing interest rates to try to slow down the rate at which the money supply is growing to maybe keep prices from rising so much.
We've got a question from Facebook. It says, and this is from Mike. Section 6 of the Florida Constitution states the right of employees by and through a labor organization to bargain collectively shall not be denied or abridged. Public employees shall not have the right to strike. And Mike asks, why isn't this enforced? Russell,
I'm not quite sure which part isn't enforced. They absolutely make it harder to organize in the state of Florida. So I'm not sure if that was the question of why that part wasn't, or the right to collectively bargain. For instance, the teachers can't go on strike. They're public employees.
Mm-hmm.
To me, and this is my take on it, is there's attack on the unions in Florida by the current political regime to make it harder and harder to be union. And yes, they do carve out the police and the fire in a lot of instances, but even that's changing because the police and fire have gone against the current regime in some issues.
Yeah. Tucker, I want to go back to you and ask a question a little bit about going back to CEO pay and things of that nature. And like, you know, I should say that like numbers don't have feelings, right? Like
yeah.
We as human beings and our pocketbooks like definitely have feelings about the numbers. And so you're just giving me the data that you're looking at. But for me, it feels like when you look at like, I can talk about the WGA because I'm versed in those issues in the strike. When we look at like what the average TV writer was making, and we also look at like the profits that were being made off of the TV writer's labor, and we look at what the CEOs are making, and it's considerably higher than what they were making before streaming got started. And the CEOs would say that like streaming has changed the whole game, and that's why they didn't want to give what the contract was asking for. But it just seems that even though you're saying that the numbers tell us that everything is kind of flat, that worker pay is rising, that with the increase with CEO pay, it feels like there's inequity in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's important to draw a distinction here between the level of worker pay and the level of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be, both things can be true at once. The average worker can be making significant gains, but at the same time, the level of inequality can be increasing. The ratio of average workers' pay to CEO pay can diverge. The question as to why that's happening is very complicated. There's a lot of argument about what's going on. I can't speak particularly to what's going on in the entertainment industry. What I can say is that it's important to draw a distinction between profits and CEO pay. Profits are what's left over after everyone's been paid, including CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece of information I can give is that CEOs do seem to be paid roughly in accordance with the value they create for companies. And the way we can tell this is we can look at what happens to firms' valuations when a CEO unexpectedly dies.
Mm-hmm.
So if a CEO is just kind of this fat cat at the top, stealing all this money from the worker, then when the CEO dies, the company's valuation shouldn't change very much. The workers are still there doing the important work. But that's not what we see. When a CEO, you know, dies in a skiing accident or whatever, there's a huge drop in the firm's valuation, which means that investors are suddenly panicking. They're saying, oh no, without the CEO, this company's not going to be as profitable, which is pretty strong evidence that the CEO is at least doing something to keep the company running.
Yes, I hear you. I would also say, though, just to push back a little bit, is that the people who are, I mean, I guess what I'm leaning towards is the fact that, like, that what we're really talking about in a lot of ways is class warfare. And if we are saying that, like, there's a group of people on Wall Street who are of the same class as the CEOs, i.e., like, we're talking about rich people who look at another rich person and say that that rich person is worth all this value, and so we're going to devalue this stock because that rich person just died. But all the poorer people are still creating the value and doing the work. It feels like, and I'm asking you, like this is not a numbers question.
Yeah.
This is like a soft question about class, or a hard question about class, and not necessarily about the numbers. It feels like, I guess what I'm saying is that those numbers and those figures are created out of thin air based off of, like, how one rich person values another rich person.
Yeah.
And not about the value of the work that the people under them, the middle class, the poorer people, create.
So this kind of connects to the greedflation question too, because you bring up a very good point. It's, you know, these are, you know, most of the trading that goes on, these are Wall Street investors. The thing is, if we're seeing this drop in firms' valuations following the CEO death, and they're actually mistaken that actually the CEO wasn't doing anything, they're wrong to make this assumption, then that creates an opportunity for an even greedier rich person to make a lot of money. Same thing with greedflation, right?
Right.
If all of these companies are colluding and keeping prices high, that creates a really strong incentive for one company to just slightly undercut them and take the entire market for themselves. So what's going on is that, you know, when we tell stories about, you know, greedflation, we're really assuming that these very rich people aren't that greedy, that they're friendly enough to cooperate with each other.
We got a caller. We're going to take Susan from Mandarin. Susan, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. I wanted to clarify, or I wanted to, I guess, speculate on what Mike was actually asking. I think he was asking whether or not DeSantis is violating our Constitution, where it says they can't abridge the rights of union. So could your guest speak about the word abridged? And thank you.
Susan, thanks so much for calling in. Russell?
Well, I'm not an attorney. I'm an electrician. But in my opinion, absolutely, DeSantis and the state of Florida is breaking the law. I think that's being taken to the Supreme Court. I do feel like they're taking away the right to unionize. They're trying to make it absolutely difficult to be union. They're trying to make it difficult for unions to survive. So in my opinion, absolutely, they're breaking the Constitution.
And we're going to take one final caller. We've got Mark in San Marco. Mark, my friend, how are you this morning?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to just make a comment with my experience in terms of wages. So I'm a hiring manager for a large corporation, and in the engineering and tech sector. And my experience has been that wages have gone up tremendously, and I find it very hard to hire talent and hire folks at a wage that makes us competitive with other organizations doing the same kind of work. So I'm curious if some of these wage issues are really sector dependent. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Tucker?
Yeah, a lot of it is sector dependent. I think that this gets back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, how much are real wages increasing. There's also a distinction that needs to be made between nominal wages, the price on the paycheck, and real wages after we adjust for inflation. Nominal wages are going up a lot, But like we were saying before, the price of everything is going up, so the purchasing power hasn't really changed.
Yeah. And that's all the time we have for this segment, guys. I could talk to both of you for another hour and figuring it all out, but I really appreciate you coming in. Russell Harper, president of North Florida Central Labor Council, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Robert Omberg, assistant professor of economics at Jacksonville University, better known as my buddy Tucker. Tucker, thanks for coming in.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And we will be right back after this break. Hey, we are back. You are listening to First Coast Connect, and Yaya Cardona was just singing to me, and I was going, the talent. What can you not do?
I know. I am extremely talented. I have a lot of little hidden gems. I can beatbox.
What? Mm-hmm. No. No, come on. You have to. You have to. I refuse to accept that no.
I can't now. I'm on the
spot.
What
are you talking about?
Oh. Listen, I promise I'll do a little video where you guys can see all me right. for real.
Yaya Cardona, woman of many hidden talents. She is here with us for Create Jax. There we go. You should do that every time.
I think I should be a jingles writer.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, look, let's make that happen.
I'm here
all
for right. it. Let's do it. So it's a lost talent.
It is a lost. You know, I still remember jingles from when I was a kid. And every now and then they'll just pop up in my head. Wake up all you sleepy heads. Colgate get you out of bed.
Okay.
We got the Colgate pump. We got the Colgate pump. Even moms and dads agree. Colgate's made with MFP. Come on.
You see, jingles are the best.
Yes.
They still work. So hit me up, businesses.
All right. I have no idea what MFP is all these years later, but I loved it. So you're here with Create Jax.
Yes.
And you're going to tell us all the great things that's going on this weekend.
Yeah, everything that's going on starting with September 28th till October 8th is Jax River City Pride Week.
What?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different activities going on. Festivals, parade. The festival and parade is October 7th and 8th. And it's going to be in various locations in Riverside, and it's free, gratis.
Mm.
So check that out.
That's always a good time.
Always a good time. I always have a great time in those events. And on September 29th, Friday, mañana Friday, is the grand opening of Literary Lounge Bookstore for all the people that love reading. This is where you want to be at tomorrow. It's the grand opening. The address is 1080 Edgewood Avenue South, and it's free 99. Mm-hmm.
Lovely.
Also, tomorrow, Friday, I have to give a shout out to Moving the Margins. The last Friday of every month, they do platinum performance, and we're going to have Caribe Groove out there with the Latin band, and we're going to have Sacoso Dance Group doing salsa and bachata classes at the Jesse. That's tomorrow, Friday, from 6 to 9, completely free.
Okay.
And in Avondale, I love Avondale. I think a lot of people don't know about Avondale and mm-hmm. all the activities that happen. Well, the last Friday of every month is Avondale's basically art walk. It's called Amplified Avondale. It's in St. John's Avenue from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. completely free. And it is super dope. They put DJs, music, artists all around the streets. So you could check that out. And then afterwards, you know, go to one of the restaurants over there.
Okay.
Support the local businesses. Why not?
Of course, of course.
That's in Avondale. That's tomorrow, Friday, starting at 6 p.m.
Got to give a shout out to Biscotti's.
Mm.
That's my spot.
Listen.
Biscotti's and the Fox. The Fox is like my morning breakfast.
I try not to talk about the Fox. I'm not going to lie, because I really don't want a lot of people going there.
The problem with the Fox is that, like, lines be crazy.
Yes.
But I just wait. Because it's
worth it.
It is worth it.
But I try not to. But shout out to the Fox for sure. Tomorrow, Friday night at the Mosh Museum. Have you been to a rooftop party at the Mosh Museum?
No, I have not.
Dude, I did a party last Saturday for Hispanic Heritage Month, and it was amazing. And so tomorrow, they're having Museum by Moonlight.
Okay.
It's $25 at the Mosh Museum. So check that out. It's going to be super dope. I'm excited about that. Saturday, if you don't have any plans, you know James Weldon Johnson Park always has your back. Mm-hmm. Well, it's their Brew and Barbecue Festival at James Weldon Johnson Park, completely free from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. If you're into beer, cervezas, if you're into barbecue, this is where you're going to want to be at. Some great live music. Bring your kids a lot of entertainment. Gratis. And that's Saturday. As well on Saturday is Jack's Melanin Market.
Okay.
Yes, Jazz on the Avenue at Everbank Stadium from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. And that is free. If you guys have never been to a Jack's Melanin Market, this is the one you want to be at. It's going to be live music, a lot of great entertainment, free 99 from 5 to 10 p.m. So when you go to James Weldon Johnson Park, go ahead and hop over there and have, you know, just plan your Saturday out. Also, on October 1st is St. John's Botanical Garden Grand Opening. Have you been to the Botanical Garden here?
No.
I know. A lot of people don't even know we have a Botanical Garden.
I was about to say, I did not know we had one.
We do. We actually do. And they do several events throughout the year.
Okay.
And so starting October 1st is St. John's Botanical Garden Grand Opening. And that's located on 8310 County Road 13 South. Okay. And that's from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. There is a free to get in. So check that out. And of course, Art Walk Mi Gente. The first Wednesday of every month,
coming
October
through.
4th. And I know for a fact we're celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. So it's going to be caliente.
All right.
Bueno, mi gente. I know at the Jesse Dupont Center, I program it with Shawana Brooks. And we're going to have Lisi and Alec. We're going to have a Hispanic showcase. We're going to have Mexican showcase dances. We're going to have Latin dancers, Latin artists. We're going to have vendors, Hispanic food. I know James Weldon Johnson Park is also doing some amazing things over there. So check that out for our Art Walk. And that's Wednesday the 4th from 5 to 9 p.m.
Caliente.
Caliente, mi gente. And also that same day on October 4th, Wednesday, is Trick or Treat Film Festival kickoff, all right? That's a film festival at Creative Venus Studio from 7 to 8:30. It's completely free to attend, but you can sign up, I guess, for a VIP for $13. And last but not least, Friday, October 6th. This one I have been looking for, and I'm excited for it.
Okay.
It's Petite Pop-Up No Trespassing Graffiti and Street Art Show.
Oh, man.
A graffiti and street art show. I don't think Jacksonville has seen that yet.
No, but I love that stuff.
Yep, and shout out to Candace Clark, who got a grant from Placemaking to create these events, and that's going to be Friday, October 6th. From 6:30 to 9:30, free. It's also family friendly, so you could take your kids out, and it's just amazing. So
I'm gonna steal your saying, free 99.
Free 99.
Ladies and gentlemen, Yaya Cardona, thank you so much for coming in.
Yes.
You got the down low on all the things to do in Jacksonville for the next couple weeks.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, make sure you check out the full list on createjax.com and follow his page on Instagram and Facebook. And shout out to Tony. That's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do this list.
Shout out to Tony, the Fox, and Biscottis.
Mm-hmm.
All right, y'all. We will be right back after this.
Great tastes, maximum fluoride protection at your fingertips.
Amelia Island presents Island Hop Craft Beer Fest, October 7th from noon to 4 p.m. Family fun with craft beer tasting, live music, food trucks, and a Main Street marketplace. Info at ameliaisland.com/islandhop.
Stories, interviews, books, puzzles, investigations, Tiny Desk, podcasts, NPR. Donate, thanks.
Please call 353-9528 and thank you.
WJCT Public Media invites you to an evening with Amna Nawaz, co-anchor of the PBS NewsHour. Amna Nawaz will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan on stage for an enlightening and engaging conversation. Tuesday, October 3rd at WJCT Studios. VIP reception is at 6 p.m., followed by the presentation at 7. For tickets and more info, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. While big labor unions push for worker rights nationwide, another labor movement is unfolding in New York City. Community organizers without union affiliations forced major food delivery apps to improve pay for their vulnerable immigrant workers. We hear from them next time here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Last time...
You have no foreign policy experience, and it shows.
And you know what? Things got lively.
Look, we're not school children. Let's have the debate.
8 contenders took to the stage earlier this month. Can the remaining 7 make a dent in the commanding lead by the man who's not bothering with the debates at all? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I don't know what this music is, but I kind of like it. It feels like, you know, hey, we're going to have a good time. Yeah. I'm Al Letson. You're listening to First Coast Connect, coming to you live from WJCT. And listener, I'm sorry, I just have to warn you, but this is about to be a serious love fest because I am with two old friends who I love so dearly and have not seen in forever. They are a part of the All Beaches Experimental Theater's new production, Alabama Story. And I have to tell you that, like, I've been calling ABET for years. I didn't even know it stood for All Beaches Experimental Theater.
It didn't for a while. It was Atlantic Beach Experimental
Theater. So now it's All Beaches.
Yes, because we're no longer in it. Beach.
All right. Well, then that makes sense. That voice you hear, ladies and gentlemen, is Lee Hamby, Managing Director at ABET. Lee, how are you this morning?
I am great. So good to see you.
Yes. And across from him is my sweetie, Simone Aden Reed, an actor playing Emily Wheelcock Reed in, Wheelock's. Thank you. Wheelock in Alabama Story. Simone, my friend.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
What was the last play we were in together?
7 to 7.
Yay! So I have been in so many theater productions with these two. It's crazy, mm-hmm. And I have not seen you in forever. Mm-hmm. So first of all, how you doing?
Good. You called us old, though.
We're all old. It's okay. It's okay. Like, I mean, literally, I was doing theater with you guys in my 20s. I am not in my 20s, listener. I am not.
Same.
So please, first of all, tell us about Alabama Story.
Well, it is a play that was originally workshopped at the Alabama Shakespeare rep. Mm-hmm. And it is based on a real event that happened in Montgomery, Alabama in 1959. The woman, Emily Wheelock Reed, who was the director of the Alabama Public Library Service, got into a battle, mm-hmm. so to speak, with a real senator. This is a real event that happened, who wanted a children's book banned because he felt like it promoted interracial marriage because it was about a black bunny rabbit that married a white bunny rabbit. And so they have a little tete-a-tete, mm-hmm. and he actually at some point tries to get rid of her. Mm-hmm. And, well, anyway, you have to come to the play to see how it ends. But it is based on a real event, and that even though it happened 64 years ago, it's still relevant today, sadly.
Yeah. Lee, what was going through your mind when you picked this show?
Well, the timeliness of it. I found it a couple of years ago, excuse me, and when all of this has, you know, been happening, I thought it was the perfect time to do it. And we are doing it during Banned Books Week, too, which is usually it's the end of September, but now it's October 1st through 7th. So I just felt it was a very important story to tell. There is a little detail in the story, too, which the writer took and mixed in a storyline where a white woman of privilege has then reconnected with a a black man, and they kind of, the story goes along with the black rabbit and white rabbit. I think it's a beautifully written story. I think it's very necessary to tell right now, for sure.
I think what, you know, theater and the arts can do is it can talk about the hard things in our world today in a way that kind of breaks through the politics and like really speaks to people's hearts. I mean, that's what it grabbed me about theater.
Oh, 100%. And that's what we're trying to do. I mean, I like to tell stories that make you think and have conversation afterwards, not just light and fluffy all the time. And this is a very sweet, it's a lighthearted drama is what this is. And it doesn't beat you over the head. It just educates you and really makes you think about what's happening.
Yeah. Simone, as a, correct me if I'm wrong, you're retired now, right?
I am. I retired a year ago.
Yes. So as a retired librarian, teacher.
I was a librarian for 3 years while I was at DA, but I was mostly a teacher. I taught English, so that has to do with books.
Yeah, yeah.
And I taught...
Does English have to do with books?
Yeah.
I hope so.
And I taught acting, which has to do with literature as well, so...
How did you respond to this part as somebody who, you know, is definitely... you basically are doing a lot... You were doing a lot of the work that the lead character is doing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I connected to it in that, you know, she's passionate about books and she grew up with books in her life. And I had a time when I was working in the library, I got to actually decide what books I should order and purchase books. And it made me think about that if I was doing it now, it would be so much harder. I would have so many rules to adhere to and probably have to deal with more people objecting to certain material.
Yeah. So, Lee, give us the details. When, where, and how?
So we open tomorrow night, September 29th. We run through October 15th, so that's 3 weekends. Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30, Sundays at 2. And you can get tickets at www.abettheater.com. And, I think that's it. Tickets are $20, and come see us, please.
Lee Hamby, Managing Director of ABET, and Simone Arden-Reed, actor and playing the role of Emily Wheelock.
Wheelock.
Thank you, Wheelock. Reed in Alabama Story at ABET. Go check it out. And that's all my time today. Thank you, lovely people, for tuning in, and we will be back tomorrow.
Sensation, every little step she takes.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.